Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to helping farm families succeed by offering financial products and services geared specifically to agriculture and rural communities and developing partnership-based relationships with its member owners.
From the Land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the sixth day of March 2018. I'm Todd Gleason, out of the office today, hosting the all-day Agricultural Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Coming up in this half hour, we'll go back and visit some interviews that I've done very recently. One of them with Scott Irwin that happened before the RINs issue actually took place last week. And he and I review what we thought was going to happen and then discussed what the impact might be. You'll want to stay and listen to that one because there are a lot of pearls and nuggets of information in there that you can use. And of course, Emerson Napsiger and I talked to him about a week and a half ago about what is and should be the case for your growing season this year. He's an agronomist from the U of I, so stay with us. And you'll hear both of those interviews on this special edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Just a quick reminder that I'm out of the office again today, so no update of the commodity markets. However, I do have a couple of things that you'll want to put in the back of your mind. We will post the audio from the all-day Ag Outlook eventually to our website at willag.org. But if you weren't able to make it here to the Beef House in Covington, Indiana, and again, I'm not here live at the moment, for the all-day, you can hear part of that tomorrow evening on Wednesday night in Mattoon at Lakeland Community College, because we'll be hosting one of our Market Outlook panels, this courtesy of the Coles County Farm Bureau. So if you want to call them to get complete details, but we'll start at 6:30 there on Wednesday evening at Lakeland Community College. And our panelists will include Todd Hubbs from here on campus at the U of I, Bill Mayer of Strategic Farm Marketing, and Mike Zuzlo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Again, this is tomorrow night, Wednesday evening at 6:30. We'll be at Lakeland College there in Mattoon, and it's free and open to everybody. That's sponsored by the Coles County Farm Bureau. And then next week, WHOW has invited us over to Clinton, Illinois. More details later on that one, but you can find out the information right now at willag.org. Todd Hubbs and Kurt Kimmel and Chip Nellinger will join us for our Market Outlook in Clinton. That's not until Wednesday the 14th, so tomorrow evening in Mattoon at Lakeland, and then a week later we'll be in Clinton with the folks at WHOW. Hey, there's one other item I hope you already have on your list of things to do. It's Explore Aces. This year's Explore Aces will be more hands-on and interactive than ever before. All ages are welcome to join us here at the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences for a variety of activities. Friday, March the 9th and Saturday the 10th, we invite all admitted students and high school juniors interested in agricultural education, agricultural communications, natural resources and environmental sciences, food science and human nutrition, or animal sciences to spend the day learning about their major or major of interest. All they have to do, really, is to show up here at the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. You can find the details on how to do that on the Explore Aces page. That's easy to get to as well, exploreaces.org. If you've listened to me long enough, you know that I believe in the future of agriculture. Yes, that's an FFA thing. However, I also believe in the future of agriculture as it's related to agriculture education and those who have gone through college and the career paths that they will have throughout their lifetime. If you've got a student that is thinking about a career path in agriculture in one of those subject areas, and again, they're just not ag-related completely, ag education, ag communications, natural resources, and environmental sciences, that's very broad, food science, and human nutrition, animal science as well, then please do have them come to Explore Aces. We'll all be here to help the students make their way across campus, but you can find all the details online at Explore Aces right now. It's exploreaces.org. That's March the 9th and 10th, this Friday and this Saturday here on campus. Hope to see you then.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
The following interview was recorded the week before last. University of Illinois agricultural economist Scott Irwin now joins us. He specializes in the economics of ethanol production and how it works with the renewable fuel standard as set forth by the United States government. He's here to talk about renewable identification numbers, or RINs, that are part and parcel of a conversation that President Trump will have on Tuesday with U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue and the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, along with two senators from Iowa and Ted Cruz from Texas, as it relates to a small refinery bankruptcy that's taking place in Pennsylvania at this point. PES blames part of its problem on the high price of RINs. First of all, Scott, I'm wondering why it is that the president would be interested in this. I can see it if it might have been Shell or BP or ExxonMobil, but PES is a much smaller player in the crude oil or gasoline supply industry.
I don't have full answers to this because, you know, the energy industry is full of extremely smart people and experienced business folks. And I don't honestly fully understand why they're so upset about RIN expenses, because either that indicates that they don't understand how their own markets operate and that there's this offset going on through higher gasoline and diesel prices to just absorb that expense, or it's a smokescreen for something else. I don't know the answer to that. I have pondered it and talked to a lot of people, and I have not come to a good conclusion. You know, the economist in me would say, you'd say they're smart, smart people and traders. They understand the markets, you know, better than anybody. So they know what's going on. So is this just a cover for general opposition to the RFS? And that they have never accepted, in essence, forcing ethanol and other biofuels into our transportation fuel supply, which was the purpose of the RFS.
So, but why go after it at this point when there's only, what, 4 years left? And the RFS ends in 2022. It's not that far away.
Well, it actually doesn't end in 2022. It's a funny thing, and I'm sure they, you know, the refiners understand this. So it's there permanently until Congress says so. But what does happen is when it was originally passed, the volumes were set in the statute, the numbers, through 2022. Then it says after 2022, the EPA, in consultation with the Secretary of Ag and lots of different organizations, can reset the volumes.
Oh, so volley one could be in the president's office.
Oh, there's, you know, one explanation for the refiners' really extreme opposition and effort and money they've spent opposing the RFS is not so much what's going on now, but as trying to set up for, you know, having a strong influence on lowering the volumes starting in 2023, which is not that far away. And that could happen.
Would they want to do that because of the number of gallons of gasoline being used in the United States have peaked? I think they peaked and are starting to trend down because of the CAFE standards, or?
No, actually, what we saw was that, I believe it was in 2007, it was either 2006 or 2007, total gasoline use in the U.S. peaked. We're back up to that peak again. So, and that actually has had major implications for the implementation of the RFS and all of these debates. Because if you look at the data the way I do, What's interesting is if you accept that the problem are high ethanol RIN prices, that's what PES, that's what the refiners, that's what everybody says. Maybe that's not really what their problem is, but let's just accept it, that at their word, that it's high RIN prices. Those D6 RINs are high because the E10 ethanol blend wall, which is the amount of gallons that is equal to 10% of our gasoline use, is below the mandate. And it has been since 2013. So you have a mandate for using ethanol that's higher than what we can use in E10.
So you can't actually blend enough ethanol to meet the mandate.
In E10.
In E10.
And
so you have to find a way around it. It could be 15 E85 or...
what it has been ever since 2013, the easier and apparently cheaper solution is biodiesel. But what's been happening, you know, there's all this noise, there's presidential meetings and everybody's looking for solutions. And I have people from Washington, D.C. calling me and there's different proposals around. And to me, you know, just cut through the noise. If you look at where, because of this fortuitous increase in gasoline consumption in the U.S. since 2004, due to two simple factors. One, price of crude oil crashed. It's recovered, obviously, quite a bit since then.
Since 2014, you mean?
Yeah. In 2014, you know, we went from basically kind of $100 crude oil to, at times, below $40. Yeah, now we've recovered in the mid-60s or a little bit lower. But we're still at substantially lower retail gasoline prices. And we've got an economy that's clearly picking up steam. That combination has caused gasoline consumption to pick up about 10%. And when that has happened, that has moved our E10 blend wall up a lot. And what I believe is being missed is that gap between the 15 billion gallon statutory mandate and what we can consume in E10 plus a little bit of E85 and E15, we're not that far away. So my argument is, in all this noise and all this heated political rhetoric and big meetings, whether you like or hate ethanol, if you're interested in the cheapest way out of this in terms of getting lower RIN prices, we need to just sit down and talk about what's the most effective way to expand our consumption of ethanol in the U.S. a few hundred million gallons. It's nothing. It's rounding error in our gasoline use, but it would have a dramatic impact on those RINs prices because you would no longer need biodiesel to fill that gap.
Hello, E15. Okay. Thanks so much.
So now, you know, that gets into another area of, you know, how practical is it? What would be the cost of ramping those up a few hundred million gallons more? I don't know. And how easy is that to do? But I do know you wouldn't have to change one jot or tittle in the RFS to do this. And with just a little nudge, the D6, high-priced D6 cost problem disappears. And the issue was, if we were, you know, we're having this conversation in 2013 or 2014, Todd, everything looked different. You know, high crude oil prices, the economy still recovering from the Great Recession, and declining gasoline use. And so what I'm talking about really just was much less feasible to do. But now we're so close. It seems like to me that this is the most practical, cheap and politically feasible way out of this quandary.
That's Scott Irwin, University of Illinois agricultural economist. Again, I recorded that interview with him prior to the meetings that took place last week about RINs and the RFS. There were a couple of them. There are more scheduled in the near future. And you can listen to this interview again online if you'd like to at WILLAG.org. It's the 5th day of March. I'm Todd Gleason out of the office today, hosting the All Day Agricultural Outlook. Now, up next, another interview from the archive, something we recorded from Malta, Illinois, a couple of weeks ago with University of Illinois Extension agronomist Emerson Nafziger. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Emerson Nafziger from U of I. He's an Extension agronomist there. Emerson, farmers in the state of Illinois across the whole of the Corn Belt have had three, four, five really good years in yields. And I'm wondering if you've had some thoughts about this and what things might be different or that might be changing as they're, just thinking about where these yields came from.
Right. Our human tendency is to think that our management is what made the difference. That's why yields were high. Honestly, anybody looking at this last year, which had a pretty rough start to it, and dry periods and wet periods and everything in between during the season, you know, if by the end of June, I think a lot of people would have sold their crop for 80 bushel less than they actually harvested. And it just showed us, some pretty amazing things. I think that's largely a consequence of the hybrids and varieties being much improved through this sort of relentless breeding pressure to produce higher yields. And that means, in many cases, just more stress-tolerant varieties and hybrids. And I think we were beneficiaries of that this last year. We still have to do things right, of course. You need to get the right amount of fertilizer on, nitrogen particularly. You need to plant early enough if you can, although this last year we replanted a huge chunk of corn. And I've been saying because of the way the summer went with the highest temperatures of July there, right in the middle of July, the replant almost certainly increased yields compared to what they would have been if we had had that earlier planted crop. We saw some of that in southwestern Illinois where they were trying to pollinate in 100-degree temperatures there in the middle of July. And those that had replanted, of course, theirs pollinated 2 weeks later and generally yielded more. So that was one of the things that we have to point to and say, well, you know, we weren't quite as much in control of this whole thing as we'd like to think we were. So I've been just emphasizing the idea that we need to use our research, get to the right place with regard to plant populations and nitrogen rates, and be careful about using things that are, you know, kind of, well, maybe this sometimes does some good, things like micronutrients and that sort of thing. We certainly don't rule out, we know micronutrients, as an example, are needed by the crop. The real question is, you know, do we routinely get a yield increase when we use them? And so far in our work, that answer has been no. So the tendency when we get high yields is also to believe that if it's inputs that make these yields high, then did we use enough? And we can often point to nitrogen in that regard on corn and say, well, it turns out 2017 looked a fair amount like 2016. In other words, we had high yields with, in most cases, moderate amounts of nitrogen. And the nitrogen rate calculator that accumulates prior research to tell us what to put on this year was pretty accurate on average in 2017. And we like when that happens, but we understand that for any given field, it's probably not going to be the exact amount you need. The problem we have is with things like nitrogen or even plant population, we don't have the knowledge at the beginning of the season to say, well, we know exactly for this field or this part of the field that we need 180 pounds of nitrogen. So our tendency is to think, well, let's make sure this one isn't limiting. And we spend money, not always wisely, with the idea that at the end of the season, we don't want to have anything on the list of things that we wish we had done because we would have gotten higher yields. I think that a reasonable way to look at this is that with today's genetics, high yields are clearly possible without doing anything extraordinary in terms of inputs. In other words, people harvested some 300 bushel corn yields and some 100 bushel soybean yields this year without going out and dumping fungicides and insecticides and micronutrients and a lot of extra nitrogen and that kind of thing. It's always a matter of a little bit of luck in that regard, because the weather turned out to be way more favorable than it looked like it was going to be in the middle of the season. But we might recall that, you know, the yield estimate for Illinois on the August 1 estimate was 188, and we ended up with 201. And I recall distinctly that the 188 seemed to almost everybody to be just way higher than we're going to get. So those kinds of surprises are nice to have. The negative surprise, like this looked like 230 bushel corn and we only harvested 180, has actually become fairly rare today, and I think that's because of the high genetics that we're dealing with.
Anything that you would suggest producers positively do for this growing season, whether it's for corn or soybeans?
We've looked at seeding rate for both corn and soybeans, and unlike some of the things you hear out there about soybeans, you know, 100,000 seeds or 110,000 seeds really is not enough. And our research showed that pretty clearly. So over the last 3 years, we've been doing trials with that, and we think that planting 140 to 150,000 seeds is just where people should be with that. And we also suggest people don't plant more with the idea that if they don't get quite as good emergence, then they'll still have enough stand to keep. We can't really afford to be keeping stands of, you know, even if they're uniform and there's 50 or 60,000 seeds out there, we probably need to, or plants out there, we need to think about replanting. Corn, we did see some trials this last year where we needed 40,000 or maybe even slightly more than that to get to the highest yield. That's been fairly rare, actually. And if you look at an average over the work we've done in recent years, establishing 35 or 36,000 in our most productive fields is generally about where we're going to get maximum yields, or I should say optimum yields. We still need to pay for that seed. One thing that's gone is this danger of having too many plants such that the crop just deteriorates, you know, falls over, falls down, dries up, this kind of thing. The stress tolerance bred into hybrids today means that we can, you know, get to 40,000 or even 45,000 plants. They're not going to fall over or fall apart. The real danger of getting to those very high populations is that last 5 or 6 or 8,000 seeds didn't pay for themselves by increasing yield. And so we could be paying more for seed than we really should be paying. I think all told that people that, you know, manage their crop in a very sort of middle of the road type of way probably are maximizing their returns at this point. Those that just feel that, you know, their secret is to use more than anybody else uses, say it be it nitrogen or seeds or anything, we don't have very good evidence that that's a paying proposition to do that.
Hey, thanks so much.
Sure.
That, of course, is Emerson Nafziger. He's an Extension agronomist. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.
It's National Chocolate Cheesecake Day. The first mention of cheesecake in history was during the ancient Olympic Games. Cato the Elder, who was born in 234 BC, wrote of cheesecake preparation in his Farming Manual de Agricultura. It's the oldest surviving work of Latin prose, which looked at up-to-date agricultural practices. American-style cheesecakes relying on cream cheese was invented in 1872.
This new high-fat cheese was developed for the Empire Cheese Company and later became known as Philadelphia brand cream cheese, which is now widely used in the creation of cheesecakes. It's also National Frozen Food Day. It was Clarence Birdseye who invented and commercialized a method for quick freezing food products. In 1923, Birdseye used a $7 electric fan, buckets of brine, and cakes of ice for packing fresh food into waxed cardboard boxes and flash freezing them under high pressure. In 1930, retail frozen foods went on sale for the first time in Springfield, Massachusetts. Various fruits, vegetables, meat, and fish were offered for sale. On this day in agricultural history in 1899, aspirin was patented by Felix Hoffmann of the German company Bayer. Aspirin was first sold as a powder. The first tablets were produced in 1915. And in 1912 on this date, Nabisco debuted the Oreo cookie. Originally, the Oreo was mound-shaped and came in two flavors, lemon meringue or cream. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for agricultural weather on WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. Whether you're looking to buy, build, or refinance, Busey will guide you through the home buying process. Busey, your dream, our promise.
For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Well, farmers figuring crop budgets for this year will face an uncomfortable reality. In order to break even on cash-rented land, generally speaking, it will require above-trend yields, higher prices, or some combination of the two. 2018 is shaping up very much like the last 2 years, says University of Illinois agricultural economist Gary Schnitke. Each of them began with dire price and income outlooks. Higher than average trend yields financially salvaged what were expected to be very poor seasons on highly productive soils in central Illinois. FBFM, or Farm Business Management records, show farmers in this area of the state harvested 228 bushels of corn per acre and 69 bushel soybeans on average in 2016, and while the numbers have not yet been fully summarized, project 2017 yields at 221 and 68, says Schnitke.
Past 2 years, 2016 and 2017, what saved us or had caused our incomes overall to be positive were high yields. You know, we had 20 bushels above that on corn. 70 bushel beans on soybeans was not uncommon, and so we've had good incomes the past 2 years because of yields, and now are we going to expect that to continue into 2018?
Factually, since 2012, corn and soybean yields in central Illinois have been at or above trend. The weather and management, says Schnitke, will need to produce another year of above trend yields in order for cash grain farmers to break even again this year.
So that's the question of the hour. If they put those 202 bushel, and we would be saying this year for that type land, 202 bushels for corn, 60 bushels for soybeans would be our trend line yield. Again, that will result in negative numbers. If you want to have a positive cash flow, you're either going to have $4 corn on that budget and above $10 soybeans, or you're going to have to put in higher yields. And again, putting, you know, 220 corn yield in there and a 70 bushel soybean yields will get you close to break even. Again, that's the same situation as we've had in 2016 and 2017. So we're, again, rolling the dice again. We either need yields above what we would regard as trend or higher prices.
Illinois' Gary Schnitke calculates break-even will require a $3.97 average cash corn price with a trend yield of 202 bushels to the acre. If the average yield is 229, then the average break-even cash price would be 350. The figures for soybean are $9.85 at the 61 bushel trend and $8.84 with a 68 bushel yield. For Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.